is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning, or afternoon, I should say. Our second case for today is 04-AP-0319, Northwest Airlines versus Wisconsin Department of Revenue. The lineup is as follows. We have 25 minutes by Mr. Schott, representing Northwest Airlines, 30 minutes by Robert Freeberg, representing Midwest Airlines, 30 minutes by Mary Burke, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, and 5 minutes by Mr. Schott in rebuttal. Agreed? Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court, my name is Don Schott, and I appear today with my partner, Dave Wilmoth. It is our great pleasure to represent Northwest Airlines in this matter. Northwest has a long history of doing substantial business in the state of Wisconsin. For example, in 2002, the tax year at issue in this appeal, Northwest operated an average of 68 flights per day in and out of airports in Wisconsin, 5 different airports. It paid over $1.5 million in property taxes to Wisconsin under a long-standing tax system whereby air carriers doing business in this state pay ad valorem tax based on the total value of their property system-wide and a percentage of their business done in the state of Wisconsin. In 2001, in response to concerns about the financial health of one of Northwest's competitors, Midwest Airlines, the legislature amended the applicable tax statute, resulting in a system where Midwest and one other airline, Air Wisconsin, would not be subject to the tax that Northwest and all other airlines pay. It did so by enacting what's called the hub exemption, which in summary form says that any airline that operates at least 45 flights a day from one airport in the state or 20 flights a day from airports in the state and has a headquarters in this state doesn't have to pay taxes on the property in this state like its competitors have to pay. Northwest is concerned about this because it denies Northwest a level playing field in its competition. As the statistics set forth in the brief show, before the hub exemption came to play, Midwest was paying about $2 million a year in property taxes.
I just want to ask a question, and that is, based on, and we've got a lot of supplementary material, newspaper articles, as I read those, this perhaps isn't as much as a legal question, but it wasn't one of the airlines at least thinking of possibly relocating in another state when you said it was because of the financial health, as far as the, quote, legislative incentives, the ad valorem tax passed, wasn't it also, or perhaps I am mistaken, but as I understood, one of the airlines was thinking of moving to another state.
Well, I think there was in the materials that submitted some indication that at least one of the airlines was thinking of expanding into another state. I would observe, however, that the property tax exemption, the hub exemption that was passed, in effect doesn't do anything either to prevent that or to encourage an airline not to do that. So to the extent that was an issue that was
I'm going to ask that.
It also has to do with the fact that the headquarters would be located in the state. In other words, the management, corporate management, would be here in the state.
If a state moved its headquarters elsewhere, I think, and I don't know exactly what Your Honor is referring to, but I think the materials that I read talked about expansions in other states, not necessarily moving a corporate headquarters to another
state.
I'm
going to ask the question a different way. Does it matter if Midwest is in the state and then you give it a tax break to protect it and keep it in the state, or does it matter if Midwest is out of the state and you give it this tax break as an inducement? Does it matter whether you're protecting your business in the state or inducing business to the state?
I think it does matter, Your Honor.
In what way?
In this way. If you are, the way this exemption works, what it does, it does not give anybody an incentive, for example, to increase their business in the state. It does not say if you spend $100 million in this state, that incremental investment will not be taxed or will be taxed at a lower rate. What it simply does is reward somebody for actions that have already occurred.
Well, suppose Northwest, you've got 65 flights. Is that what you said?
Yes.
All right. Can you have more than one headquarters?
The statute said that headquarters would be defined by rule of the Department of Revenue, and I think in most cases it would probably not be permissible to have more than one state as a headquarters state. So I believe the answer to your question is no.
Okay, but if you wanted the tax benefit, you could just move your corporate headquarters.
Well, you could move your corporate headquarters and you have to meet the requirement of number of flights. But I think
meet the requirements for number of flights now?
Northwest meets that requirement for number of flights right now. But I think, Your Honor, that argument is a little bit like saying we're going to place a tax on professional basketball players and their income that they earn in the state, but we will exempt any basketball player that plays for a team that plays 50% of its games within the state. And then if the Lakers complain about that, or the Bulls complain about that, or the Timberwolves complain about that, say, well, you can always just move your team to Wisconsin. It doesn't work. The NBA wouldn't function if all the teams were located in Wisconsin. Airlines
would function quite well if all the headquarters were in Wisconsin.
Depending on what other states did in response to that, Your Honor, and it could lead to the exact kind of balkanization that the Dormant Power of the Commerce Clause is designed to protect against. In other words, you would have a number of other states attempting to do similar things and require headquarters to be within the state. I think it's quite clearly a problem under the Dormant Power of the Commerce Clause to require a state in order to get a tax benefit to be headquartered in that state.
Is it a violation to require X number of flights? Suppose they took out the headquarters. Would X number of flights be okay?
It would not be a violation of the Commerce Clause, I believe, if you said to give you an incentive to increase your flights, we will say if you increase your flights, we will give you a tax break on that incremental investment. The problem here is that this hub exemption does not do that. It does not provide an incentive for anybody to do anything. Once this exemption was passed, there were $2.5 million of tax revenue spent, and no one had to do anything to do that. There was no additional investment that either Midwest or Air Wisconsin had to do. They didn't provide any more jobs, any more investment. There was no incentive in the sense that anybody had to do anything to qualify for this exemption, no additional incremental investment or economic growth. And in fact, you have a very perverse situation where if, for example, Northwest decided to spend $25 million building a new facility in Green Bay or spend money to increase its flights to Central Wisconsin Airport or Dane County Airport, it would get absolutely no benefit from doing that, yet its competitors would.
How were you hurt by this tax exemption?
We are hurt by the simple fact that their cost got reduced by $2 million. Our cost did not. They have an advantage over us in that their cost structure is lower.
What's the advantage? If you had the tax exemption, would you be building something? Or would you be lowering your rates? Or having more flights? What would you do if you had the tax exemption?
Well, I think that to pass constitutional muster, the tax exemption itself, the tax incentive itself, would have to define that. In other words, the legislature can pass tax exemptions. The legislature can use the taxing system to provide incentives, but what it must do is say, here's what you have to do to get that incentive. Our view is that a tax incentive is perfectly proper, but it has to be based on what you do, not where you live. It has
Don't you want the money back that you paid?
We want to be treated equally. We want a level playing field.
You want the money back, don't you?
We want a level playing field. That could be accomplished in one of two ways. Either everybody gets taxed or nobody gets taxed. We think under these facts, the appropriate remedy, given what we believe was the legislature's intent, would be that nobody gets taxed. But our main concern is a level playing field.
If nobody gets taxed, what would you have done to earn that? The others, one has made the state its corporate headquarters, but then both of them made it corporate headquarters, and one has an enormous number of departing flights. What are you going to do to earn the exemption, get your money back?
No, at this point, when that exemption was passed, nobody did anything to get a tax break. And that is our concern. I think you can use the tax system to provide incentives, but the incentive, by its very definition, means you're using the tax code to encourage somebody to do something. This incentive does not do that. It's not an incentive. Nobody had to do anything in order to get that exemption. It treats us unequally because if we wanted to qualify for the exemption, we would have to do something. And quite perversely, what we would have to do, we could expand at various airports in the state, we could add flights, we could add facilities, and none of that would do anything for us, would not give us any tax break. The only thing we could do to qualify for this exemption would be to operate another hub facility in the state and query whether Milwaukee, Wisconsin is a large enough air market to have two hub airlines with 45 flights a day out of that airport. So this was not a use by the legislature of a tax incentive to encourage additional investment in the state, to encourage growth in the state, to encourage additional air service in the state. Instead, it was simply a tax exemption that applied to conduct that had already occurred, provides no incentive, and in fact, quite perversely, provides us with no incentive for doing things, but other airlines will get that exemption only because of where they live. Oh,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's fine.
Sentence. I'm missing something, so I need your assistance. Why doesn't sub A, 2A, as compared to B, and of course I'm talking about 70.11, 42, A, 2A. Doesn't that define hub facility in two ways? Sub B is you need a headquarters. Sub A doesn't carry with it that requirement, but just a higher number of flights.
Out of one airport. 45 flights a day out of one airport.
Well, isn't that an incentive?
Yes, it is an incentive. It is a very peculiar incentive given the circumstances. Number one, it doesn't reward any other type of conduct. It only rewards one type of conduct. And as I mentioned before, as a practical matter, having two airlines with a Milwaukee hub, 45 flights a day on average for both airlines, is a practical impossibility. It's like saying all the NBA teams have to be headquartered or playing all their home games in Wisconsin. It just isn't going to happen that way. You're not going to have Milwaukee, Wisconsin be the airline hub of the country. So as a practical matter, it doesn't fit.
Mr. Shadid, has Northwest gone to the legislature and asked the legislature to give you an incentive for a tax exemption?
I know we went to the legislature and said we wanted a level playing field, that we wanted, if there was going to be, we'd be happy if with the existing system, if there was going to be some type of an exemption or some type of property tax incentive program, it ought to be an incentive program that applies equally to anybody. It ought to be a tax system based on rewarding what you do, not where you're located. That's our main point.
How many hubs does Northwest have?
Three.
Is it receiving any incentives for having those hubs?
Yes, it has received incentives, and they have been of the type that I've indicated. In other words, they've been incentives where the legislatures of various places have said, if you make an incremental investment, if you build a new facility, if you add additional flights, if you make an investment, we will not tax that incremental investment. And we think that's entirely appropriate. That's absolutely appropriate, constitutional, proper tax policy for a state to follow. If I can, I'd like to use the Cuno case from Ohio as an example of different ways that these things can be structured. That's the case that...
I have a question for you about that, but maybe you'll answer it as you proceed. Should this Court just hold off until the U.S. Supreme Court decides that case?
That's a very interesting question, and we talked about that ourselves. I think not, Your Honor, and let me explain why I think our case is distinguishable from that case. In Cuno, recall, the city of Toledo was worried about the Chrysler Jeep plant moving, and so a number of incentives were offered to Chrysler to keep that plant there. The first incentive was a property tax exemption that did exactly what I've been talking about. It said, if you make this investment in our plant, in your plant in Toledo, we will not tax that incremental investment. That's an incentive for you to make this investment, and we will not tax that investment. And the Sixth Circuit said that's proper, that's constitutional, that does not run afoul of the dormant power of the Commerce Clause. The second incentive they provided was to say to Chrysler, you're already in the state, you're already operating in the state, and therefore are subject to our franchise tax. If you make this additional investment, we will give you a credit against the taxes already due and owing, that you already have due and owing to the state of Ohio under our franchise credit. And the Sixth Circuit said, that you cannot do. That is unconstitutional because it rewards or the economic benefit depends upon existing activity already in the state, and therefore it's unconstitutional. Now, if that's unconstitutional, then I think this case is an even more extreme example where this exemption doesn't say we're going to be taxing you on some incremental benefit that you bring to the state of Wisconsin by additional investment, but on stuff that's already occurred. So if the franchise tax exemption in Cuno is unconstitutional, then clearly this hub exemption is unconstitutional. And to go back to the Chief Justice's question, I think that's a way of distinguishing those cases. It could be that that second tax program, the franchise tax program in Cuno, could be found by the U.S. Supreme Court to be either constitutional or unconstitutional. I don't think that necessarily drives the decision here. I think you have a further way of distinguishing this tax because at least the franchise tax in Cuno was based on additional incremental value. But recall what the real problem was that the Sixth Circuit found. It's because the value of that tax benefit depended upon already existing business in the state. That tax incentive was more valuable to Chrysler because it already was doing business in Ohio. It wouldn't have the same value to some company that wasn't already doing business. Well, that's clearly the example here, this exemption as a benefit to Midwest and Air Wisconsin. Because of past action, it's not an incentive for future action.
Mr. Shah.
Go ahead, Justice Butler. I'll catch him up.
Thank you, Justice Rogenczak. In a couple of portions in your large brief, the red brief, on page 4 and on page 13, you argue that the tax exemptions at issue in this case on its face violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. Are you limiting your argument to an on-its-face challenge here?
I would say I'm limiting our argument to that, but I believe that since this statute is discriminatory on its face, there's no need to go any further.
Well, the reason I ask the question is there's two different subsections of the statute. There's subsection A and there's subsection B. And can you please direct me to where on its face subsection A is discriminatory?
Yes. Subsection A says that you get an exemption based on conduct that you already have that has already taken place in this state. In other words, the two similarly situated airlines, Northwest and Midwest, to take examples, one will be exempt and one will not be exempt. One can make additional investments and have those exempted. One can make additional investments and not have those be exempted. And the only distinguishing factor between the two is that one has these 45 flights per day within the state and the other does not. So it depends upon activity within the state.
In the next year, Northwest, for sake of argument, could operate 45 flights from one airport. I'm not talking about sub B, I'm talking about sub A now. So I guess I fail to see how that discriminates in favor of intrastate activity and penalizes interstate activity. I mean, that's what I'm looking for help with.
Okay, let me try to address that specifically. Let's say that both Northwest and Midwest decided to spend $25 million to build a new facility somewhere in the state of Wisconsin. Under this hub exemption, that new property would be exempt from taxation when constructed by Midwest. It would not be exempt from taxation when constructed by Northwest. And the only reason for that difference is because Midwest operates 45 flights a day out of an airport in the state of Wisconsin and Northwest doesn't.
But maybe, so, maybe I'm not making my question clear. Why couldn't Northwestern then operate 45 flights per day? I understand your as-applied challenge, but I don't see how on its face the statute is discriminatory.
Maybe we're just having a difference of semantics. I think that's clear on the face of the statute because it makes that type of classification. The example I gave specifics, but you could just say facially, if you took two airlines, unnamed airlines, with these facts, it would treat those two differently, and facially I believe that that is discriminatory treatment. I wanted to talk about what I'm sorry, Justice Rogan-Sack, you had a question earlier.
Yeah, thank you very much. I want to know, are the tax exemptions permissible under 49 U.S. Code 4116, only those that engender prospective conduct, as you're arguing, are permissible under the Commerce Clause?
No. I think the analysis under that statute is a little bit different. I'm glad you raised the question of the statute. I think the important point to focus on with respect to that federal statute, that's an argument that has come up late in this case, wasn't decided by Judge Albert because that wasn't raised at the time. But recall the history of that statute. Initially, the United States Supreme Court ruled that taxes on airlines were constitutional as long as they were applied in a non-discriminatory way. Congress became concerned about that, and you think about it, there are three different areas of concern that Congress has under the Commerce Clause, at least three. One is that even non-discriminatory taxes can be burdensome, can affect interstate commerce even if they're applied in a non-discriminatory way. The second concern is a concern that certain types of commerce might be treated differently than others. For example, railroads and airlines might be treated differently than manufacturing. And the third type of discrimination that Congress can be concerned of is what I could refer to as local interest discrimination or hometown protectionism type discrimination. The statute deals very specifically with the first question, which is burdensome taxes, even if non-discriminatory, by saying certain taxes are just prohibited, anti-head tax, and limits the ability to impose other taxes. It deals with the second situation by saying, if you're going to levy a tax, you cannot play around with assessment ratios, you cannot play around with tax rates to treat airline property or railroad property differently than you do manufacturing property, for instance. The argument that's now being made by the state and Northwest is, well, you should also assume that when Congress did that, enacted that statute to do that protection, and then they put in sub E that just says this doesn't prohibit anything else, a savings clause, but that means that this whole area of hometown or local interest protection is now gone. The Dormant Commerce Clause no longer applies, and you can act any kind of protectionist measure that you want. To put that in specific examples, if you follow the argument, it would say the state of Illinois couldn't put a tax on airline passengers because that's prohibited by the anti-head tax provisions. They couldn't say we are going to tax airlines property, but we're going to tax it at 110% of fair value and everything else gets taxed at 100% of fair value. But they could pass a law that says we're going to tax all airline property in this state, but we're going to exempt United Airlines because they have a headquarters in the state of Illinois. It makes no sense to assume that that's what Congress was about when it passed the federal statute. So I think the federal statute is still subject to the dormant power of the Commerce Clause. Now, I've gone a long way to answer your question, but I think the bottom line, Your Honor, is that the dormant power of the Commerce Clause still applies to analyzing the appropriate actions of states under the after the passage of the anti-head tax. In the area of discrimination between types of commerce, Congress has spoken and indicated on those areas, these are the rules, these are four specific things that are prohibited, but with respect to anti-protectionist discrimination, that dormant power of the Commerce Clause still acts to protect the states.
Okay, well, my question was much simpler. Your answer was very nice. I just wanted to know if under that statute, we were as limited as you have described under the Dormant Power Clause to giving economic incentives for prospective conduct. You're saying one of the reasons this statute is unconstitutional is because it only applies to things that folks have already done. And so you can't do that. And I understand that argument well. And my question was, is that same limitation imported into 40 U.S. Code or 49 U.S. Code 4116?
Thank you. And I think it's the interplay of being prospective and dependent upon where you are located, where your economic activity is. If I could, I know I'm not, I have very little time left, I could turn very briefly to the question of timely service of the action here. I'd like to address that very briefly. In October of 2002, we received notice from the Department of Revenue that our 2002 tax assessment would be about $1.5 million. That notice also said, quote, if you feel aggrieved by this assessment notice, you may appeal its assessment by filing a summons and complaint directly with the Dane County Circuit Court. This appeal must be filed within 30 days after this notice was mailed to you pursuant to Section 76.08 of the Wisconsin statutes. That's it. That's entire instructions that were given by that notice. We did feel aggrieved by that assessment. We did exactly what the notice told us to do. We filed a summons and complaint in Dane County Circuit Court within 30 days, and we served that on the Department of Revenue within the 90-day time period authorized by Section 801.02 of the statutes. The Department of Revenue made a motion to dismiss, taking a position that under 76.08, both filing and service of the summons and complaint must take place within 30 days.
Mr. Schott, was the statute attached to the notice?
No.
But there's reference directly in the notice to the statute?
Yes.
What is the language of the statute?
The language of the statute, it's a very long sentence, and it has two clauses in it. There's a 30-day time limit, then there's a clause that talks about commencement of the action by filing the summons and complaint in the court, then there is a comma, and then there is a second clause that talks about service upon the Department of Revenue. And we think the fact that there are two clauses separated by a comma is very significant. Under the normal rules of grammar, under the normal rules of statutory construction, by having a comma separate those two clauses, they become independent clauses, and the modifier that begins at the beginning modifies only the first clause and not the second clause. Now, DOR takes a different interpretation. I think the important point for you to focus on is in deciding who's right and who's wrong, the test that applies to DOR's argument is that they must show that their interpretation is the only reasonable interpretation of the statute. And the reason I say that is because in the Peterson case, this court made very clear that if there's an ambiguity in a statute, procedural statute, it is to be, quote, liberally construed to permit a determination upon the merits. The definition of ambiguity that this court has used is, quote, capable of being understood in two or more ways by reasonable people. Put differently, DOR would have to show that no reasonable person would look at this statute and feel that the normal rules of statutory construction and grammar apply.
If I might.
Justice Butler?
Mr. Schott, I know your red light is on, but would you very briefly address the severability issue?
Yes. The key question there is what would the intent of the legislature be? Would having this exemption be struck down, if this exemption is struck down, having it severed be consistent with the intent of the legislature or not? And there, I think it's a very interesting question. The state spent a lot of time in their brief talking about legislative intent, but that was typically the cases that they cite really deal with the question of statutory meaning. What we have here is a different question. We know what the statute means, but if this court rules the statute is unconstitutional, the question is, what would the legislature have done if the question had been posed to it? We know what you want to do. If that's unconstitutional, you can't do that. As between these two options, what would you do? We have very specific guidance on that question because the court was given direction by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. If you don't want to take the risk that this will be declared unconstitutional and nobody's taxed, then put in a severability clause. They chose not to do that. I think that's a very clear indication of legislative intent. I apologize for running over my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Freebert, representing Midwest Airlines.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, and please the Court. With me at counsel table is Matthew O'Neill. This appeal does not involve the Dormant Commerce Clause. It took 20 minutes to get into the argument before CUNA was mentioned, and I figured out that they were talking about the Dormant Commerce Clause. The only question in this case is whether the Wisconsin Hub Facility Exemption is allowed by Section 40.116, the federal statute defining the scope of a state's authority to tax air carriers. This is a very, very unusual statute. It's a similar statute for railroads, motor carriers, and air transportation. Congress, after 15 years of hearings, defined what constituted discrimination against interstate commerce. And that's the phrase they use. This is what constitutes discrimination against interstate commerce. In creating this definition, Congress weighed many important and competing economic and states' rights interests. And you heard in the argument what all those interests were. There are many, many competing economic and states' rights interests. Included in the discussion was the local interest in maintaining adequate transportation in order to have interstate commerce at all. You have to have adequate transportation. Congress exercised its plenary authority to regulate interstate commerce, struck the balance it deemed appropriate between all of these competing interests. Northwest does not like the balance that was struck by the Congress, because applying the definition created by Congress, there is no discrimination as defined by Congress. And so Northwest's answer is, forget about the statute. They say the court should decide this case without reference to the statute and apply Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence. Northwest is essentially asking this court to allow a direct challenge to the careful balance struck by Congress, and in doing so, if they allow, and there can be a direct challenge to the balance struck by Congress, it would subvert the balance struck by Congress. However, the law is very clear. Once Congress strikes the balance, Dormant Commerce Clause review is inappropriate, and every other court that has interpreted 40.116 has held that Dormant Commerce Clause review is inappropriate, citing the Marion case. And that starts with the United States Supreme Court interpreting 41.16 in County of Kent, cited Marion. Now, under the Act, Northwest is required to show that their property tax rate is higher than the property tax rate of commercial and industrial property as defined by Congress. In other words, the commercial and industrial property is what's known as the comparison class. We have their rate.
Tell us exactly what provision of the statute you're talking about. Tell us exactly what provision of the statute you're talking about.
Yes. It's 40.116. I have to get this. Paren D, small d, paren 2 paren A. Maybe it's just 2 paren A.
Well, 2 paren A has 4 subparts.
Yes, and we are talking about sub little Roman 3, which is the levy or collect an ad valorem tax on air carrier transportation property.
Okay.
I'm reading from it, at a tax rate greater than the tax rate applicable to commercial and industrial property in the same assessment jurisdiction. Commercial and industrial property is defined at paren large D. And that says commercial and industrial property means property except transportation property and land use primarily for agriculture timber growing devoted to commercial and industrial use and subject to a property tax levy. The phrase, what does subject to a property tax levy mean, was decided by the United States Supreme Court in ACF Industries, and they decided that the phrase subject to a property tax levy meant property that is taxed, not taxable, and therefore exempt property will not be in the comparison class. And the United States Supreme Court very specifically said that in passing this act, Congress intended to allow states to grant exemptions. And that's what the history, text, and the of this act is. In addition, we're also dealing with transportation property, which is another exception to the comparison class. And it reads very easily, I think, to me it's easy. It's a complicated statute, I think. It says, commercial industrial property means property except transportation property. We are transportation property. And what that means, and ACF talked about this not in terms of transportation property, but in terms of the other phrase, land use for agriculture or timber growing. And they said Congress meant to allow states to tax transportation property at different rates. And that's how Congress struck this balance. And it's important that this balance was struck after 15 years of intensive discussion between, in that case, the railroads, between the states, between local government, between all the various economic and states' rights interests and local interests, and this is the balance that Congress struck. Now, they come in and they say, and this is their case, forget about that statute, and we can say attack an exemption granted to transportation property despite what Congress said you can't do.
I think you cited an ACF case.
Yes.
What were the facts in that case?
Pardon?
What were the facts in that case?
Facts of that case was that there were the state of Oregon granted a whole bunch of exemptions. It's not in the case, but I know that in reading other material that over 66% of the property in the state was exempted, and several rail carriers came in and said, we are being discriminated against because of the exemptions. And the United States Supreme Court said, you can't attack exemptions. Congress says you can't attack exemptions.
Did some of the rail carriers have the exemption and others not have the exemption? So it was rail carriers taxed, certain non-rail carriers not taxed.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Recognizing the legitimacy of exemptions, is any exemption going to fly if it involves transportation? Let's suppose the legislature had said, we're going to give exemptions to all air carriers in Wisconsin except those headquartered in Minnesota. Is that going to fly?
Well, I'm just dealing with the regulation of interstate commerce. The United States Supreme Court and the Congress said you can't challenge exemptions unless you, at the end of the day, you're the only company taxed.
Exemptions of what? Other transportation company or commercial property?
Commercial property.
That's what I thought. So as long as that commercial property, which is taxable in this state, you have to use the same rate for transportation companies.
No. Transportation property is not part of the comparison class. You can use a different rate.
What is that? Levy or collect an ad valorem property tax on air carrier transportation property at a tax rate greater than the tax rate applicable to commercial and industrial property.
Right.
So can't be greater than that.
It can't be greater. Their tax rate when they come into court can't be greater than the tax rate of commercial and industrial property, which in the and the comparison class excludes transportation.
Right. So it doesn't matter how Midwest is taxed. What matters is commercial property taxed in the state. That's the comparison.
Yes, for them to.
And the exemption is of commercial property. So if they exempted 2/3 of the commercial property, wouldn't matter.
Wouldn't matter.
Okay.
Yes.
You only look at the 1/3 that's taxed, same rate for everybody.
Yes. And that's ACF. 2/3 were exempt.
All right.
And everybody else was taxed at the same rate. And when you get to the comparison class, it's the same rate because you take the tax rate and you don't include in calculating what the tax rate is for commercial industrial property. You don't include in that calculation exempt property, and you don't include in that calculation transportation property because Congress said that was neither of those were part of the comparison class. In direct answer to Justice Prosser's question, under the Dormant Commerce Clause, Congress can strike the balance any way they can. And the text of the statute, the plain text of the statute, does not allow these kinds of distinctions. It under ACF, it's any exemption. That would not preclude argument under equal protection or other due process or other provisions of the Constitution. But on Dormant Commerce Clause matters. Congress is the last word. There is no, the clause is not dormant once Congress has struck the balance. And if a state were to do something like that and it were to work some kind of perceived impropriety, the answer is go to Congress, don't go to court, because Congress is the word on it, and the rules on it are very clear on Marion. Once Congress strikes the balance, the Commerce Clause does not need the assistance of the judiciary to protect interstate commerce, and Congress can, according to Marion, grant or allow states to engage in certain kinds of conduct which would violate the Dormant Commerce Clause had Congress not acted.
Okay. Counsel, you're talking about a balance, it sounds to me, between the interstate or the tax on air carriers, interstate, and the tax on commercial and industrial properties. Is that what you're talking about? That's what ACF was talking about, and that's what you're
talking
about.
That's what the statute says.
That's what the statute, some 3, talks about. But why does that have anything to do with this case?
Because
it seems to me we're talking about competition not between an air carrier and a commercial and industrial enterprise, but we are talking about competition among air carriers. It doesn't seem like ACF touches that. It doesn't seem like sub 3 addresses that.
The text of the statute doesn't allow that kind of an interpretation. It doesn't say it doesn't excuse property subject to a tax levy as long as it's not competitors. So you could have, and there has been a case in the California Supreme Court, where air carriers were taxed higher than railroads. They're in competition, too, for interstate commerce. And the California Supreme Court said that because the railroad is transportation property, they're not in the comparison class, and the airlines lose. That's American Airlines, San Mateo. Northwest was a party to that case. So there are any number of ways that you can believe that there is a certain kind of issue and competition, but Congress has struck the balance. And the text of the statute doesn't, I don't think, allow for those kinds of interpretations.
That ACF case, in interpreting the text of the statute, the balance you say that Congress struck, it says, ACF, Congress had to do this because it was aware that interstate carriers were, quote, easy prey for the state and local tax assessors, and that they are non-voting, often non-resident targets for local taxation who cannot easily remove themselves from the locality. seems to me that they're talking there about, you know, don't pick on interstate carriers rather than the local commercial industrial.
But the text, that's true, but the court also said at ACF about half the state's grant property tax exemptions to encourage investment in air and water pollution control devices, and that was also part of the matrix, and that permitting exemptions was very important for economic development, and that they struck the balance in very clear language. And the language says what it says. And what the question implies, Justice Bradley, is that the court can read out of the statute or read into the statute something other than subject to a property tax levy and say not all exemptions come under that, but that is not the language that Congress used.
What the question is meant to imply is the standard here is that it has to be unmistakably clear. And given the language of sub 3 that compares interstate air carriers with what I'm filling in now, local, commercial, and industrial property, given language in the ACF case, it may be, you might be right, but does this language unmistakably and clearly say what you're saying?
I think the test is Marion, which is cited by every case, including the United States Supreme Court in County of Kent, in looking at this section of the United States Code to hold that Congress, that there is no dormant Commerce Clause review. And Marion itself is a case where you have competing interests and Congress strikes the balance. And Congress, there can be no question after 15 years of looking at this that Congress intended to strike the balance between all of the competing interests and did so in very clear language. And Marion says after all of that, at least that was in a different setting, allowing taxation on Indian lands, that it struck the balance. And the interesting thing about Marion is, and I refer that it's not cited in the brief, but footnote 21 of Marion is very significant, and it says, although Congress has not expressly announced that Indian taxes do not threaten its latent power to regulate interstate commerce, it is unclear how Congress could articulate that intention any more convincingly than it has done here. And I say that this is exactly the same thing in the text and structure of this act. How could, I mean, Congress was absolutely clear, and in fact, if we were to allow a dormant Commerce Clause challenge, it would threaten and subvert the policy choices Congress makes. In other words, the first question is the dormant Commerce Clause dormant? If it is not dormant, the inquiry ends. If the court concludes that for some reason the dormant Commerce Clause is dormant and goes on to dormant Commerce Clause analysis, then all arguments are wide open. All exemptions can be threatened. All differences in taxation, there's no limit on it because the text doesn't, either the Commerce Clause is dormant or it is not dormant. And if it is dormant, then the very structure of the act created by Congress can be brought under attack. And the California case, the Supreme Court in San Mateo, you can say, well, look, railroads get a better deal than we do. And even though this act says that, the dormant Commerce Clause is dormant, forget the statute, put it aside, and we're going to challenge that. We're going to challenge all exemptions. We're going to challenge exemptions that are given to motor carriers. We're going to challenge all of that. Congress looked at it all and struck the balance. And it's very clear And I think it would subvert the statutory plan of Congress. And ACF hints at that, although in some very strong language in the ACF decision. ACF, part of the issue was that there was a fourth provision in ACF, a catch-all provision which is not present in the law involving air carriers. And that fourth provision is where Congress said that they would prohibit unreasonable taxes, just a kind of a catch-all provision. Unreasonable in the context of all of this, we believe, brings into play dormant commerce clause jurisprudence. And in fact, the Kent case was decided the exact same day as ACF by the United States Supreme Court. I don't think those are accidents. I think they can be read together. In the Kent case, the phrase and use of language reasonable and unreasonable was concluded by the United States, in the statute, was concluded by the United States Supreme Court to bring into play dormant commerce clause jurisprudence. So, stepping back a second, under the ACF decision, what the United States Supreme Court was looking at says, look, we have all these exemptions in Oregon, and then we have this catch-all phrase that generally prohibits unreasonable taxes. And the question was, once you get past the first part, which we're talking about here, namely exemptions are allowed, can you still attack, can you, under the Act of Congress, whether the exemptions are unreasonable or applying, I would think, dormant commerce clause jurisprudence. The U.S. Supreme Court said no. No. And they said it in very clear language. For example, it would be illogical, this is the Supreme Court, to conclude that Congress, having allowed states to grant property tax exemptions in B1-3, would turn around and nullify its own choice in subsection B4. The unreasonable, you don't even get there. That was the real issue in ACF. The court also said in the context of discrimination against agriculture rate in passing, which is the same area that excludes transportation property, that in getting to this decision, that the fact that Congress made this particular exclusion, and that was agriculture purposes, and that's in the same section as transportation property, it's an exclusion, demonstrates its intent to permit the states to tax railroad property at a higher rate than agriculture land. And you can put in their transportation, because agriculture and transportation are the same boat.
Counselor, can I interrupt you for just a second? Just say we get beyond your argument and somehow we decide we do want to look at the Dormant Commerce Clause. Do you agree with Attorney Schott that the only types of exemptions that are permissible as a constitutional incentive are those that require prospective conduct on the part of the person who's the beneficiary of the exemption?
No, and I can't imagine that that would wind up as the law. There are so many incentives given, even in this state, I'm confident, in Milwaukee, the Menominee River Valley has a ton of tax incentives. You get incentives for taxes for Janesville to keep the General Motors plant. You used to have it for Kenosha. There is nothing unusual, nor has the United States Supreme Court ever said that you can't fight to maintain your position in protecting interstate commerce. He said two times, by the way, that this test on dormant, we're now into dormant commerce clause analysis, he said two times, and I wrote it down, that it should be based on what you do, not where you live. Now, the statute that was correctly questioned by Justice Bradley has nothing to do with where you live. The section dealing with interstate commerce flights, you can live anywhere as long as what you do is in Wisconsin. And that's the part that is I don't understand the statement based on what you do, not where you live. That may be fine for the second requirement, as Justice Bradley pointed out, where you need to have your headquarters in Wisconsin, but it's not, certainly not part of the Act, which requires what you do with the state. Now, on Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence, the United States Supreme Court has said that every analysis is a case-by-case basis. And that's because this area of the law of Dormant Commerce Clause has been rightly termed a quagmire, and that's not by me, it's by some justices of the United States Supreme Court, and it is a quagmire. It's all case-by-case. There are no real great general overarching principles, and therefore, let's take a look at this quagmire in the context of the one case where you have airline service discrimination against airline service discrimination. That case is County of Kent. County of Kent. And it's all over our briefs. In that case, there was an airport user fee which looks like it's discriminatory on its face. 100% of the tax is allocated to Northwest, but General Aviation only paid 20% of the tax. And Northwest, the same plaintiff, went to the United States and Supreme Court and said that discriminates under the Act and also under the Dormant Commerce Clause. The United States Supreme Court, in that case, Northwest versus County of Kent, said, and this is the only case in the U.S. Supreme Court which has air carrier versus air carrier with an obvious, apparent, on its face discrimination in a fee. The United States Supreme Court said, you don't even get to argue Dormant Commerce Clause analysis because you didn't show that General Aviation only operates in intrastate commerce. And unless you show that, you've not demonstrated discrimination against interstate commerce and in favor of intrastate commerce. That is the only case where you have air carrier and air carrier type service, and the distinction made by the United States Supreme Court was just what I said. In order for them to prevail under the Dormant Commerce Clause, and this is the only case of its kind, and it's like ours, they have to show that they are discriminated in favor of intrastate carriers only, which, of course, they can't do. And, of course,
Mr. Freeburg, if I can ask you about that. Obviously, there's a distinction in the statute. There's two statutory definitions, sub A and sub B. How does the County of Kent argument apply to sub B?
On sub B, the County of Kent argument might not, excuse the expression, fly. But my client is under A and B, so we don't care particularly about that.
The reason I ask the question is if under sub B, County of Kent does not fly, and should we reach that question, how do we approach the severability issue?
Yes, on the remedy, actually, we agree with the position of Northwest, but for different reasons. Our position is that this is in a violation, which we don't concede, of course, but in a violation of the Commerce Clause, that we have certain decisions. We have McKesson in the United States Supreme Court, which says that there's a requirement, a due process requirement, that there be retrospective relief from whatever tax has been paid. And we think that that the remedy, therefore, is that they, under this kind of a violation, if it is determined to exist, is that they get the exemption, that you even out the sides by giving them the same relief.
And back to the legislature? We send it back to the legislature?
Yes, because, and McKesson talks about this, and I'm not sure if it was in the United States Supreme Court, I think it was, or in the Supreme Court of Florida, but it talks about that the decision on whether to grant exemptions or not grant exemptions are peculiarly legislative and peculiarly different challenges and different things that requires legislative thought. And this Court has, and we also think in this terms that not only is this an appropriate remedy under the Commerce Clause, but also an appropriate remedy in dealing with separation of powers. Because when you take away an exemption, it's imposing a tax. And whatever else might be said about the legislature intended not to tax any airline that meets these requirements. So at the end of the day, by taking away the exemption has the effect of legislating a tax. And I think this Court was sensitive to this issue in Burlington Northern. So we don't view this exactly as a severability question. We view this more as that the Court should stay its hand, not legislate a tax by getting rid of an exemption, and also under the Commerce Clause that this is the appropriate remedy, applying McKesson. It would be a very peculiar result under McKesson, where due process requires retrospective return of monies paid, but that this doesn't go forward. It would encourage companies not to ask for declaratory and injunctive relief and just sue to return the money, and every year they come in and they sue to return the money, and that would have that impact.
So your point is you don't want your client taxed should this exemption be held unconstitutional.
That's right. I don't. If it's held to be unconstitutional, then I certainly do not want my client to pay this tax.
You're willing to have Northwest pay the tax either.
Well, they got a big break when they left Milwaukee to go to Minneapolis many years ago.
I got from the record. There's another question. Justice Prosper.
If Northwest prevails and gets its taxes back, what's the total cost of the state of Wisconsin?
I'm not sure what that would be today. I believe the state would know that. I think it's under $10 million for all airlines, I believe, but I'm not sure.
I ask that to Ms. Burke.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Freeburg.
Thank you.
You'll have to give us a moment so we can change the disc so we get you recorded, Ms. Burke. Representing the Department of Revenue Council, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Commerce Clause prevents states from imposing barriers to free trade and promotes free trade among the states. It doesn't prohibit the states from competing with each other for economic investment. The states are free to design their tax systems in a manner that will promote investment for the purpose of providing jobs and prosperity for their citizens. There have been several questions about whether those incentives must be forward-looking, must only support new investment. I'm not aware of any case that would hold that. I believe that it's equally permissible under the Commerce Clause to support the well-being of the citizens of the state and the state's economy by assisting the state in maintaining the commerce and industry already present there. That's a policy decision for the legislature. The case law is very clear in this area of designing tax incentives that these are policy decisions for the legislature to make as elected representatives of the people. The resulting legislation doesn't violate the Commerce Clause unless it does one of two things. It violates the Commerce Clause if it deprives citizens of the right to access markets of other states on equal terms. It also violates the Commerce Clause if it discriminatorily taxes the products manufactured or the transactions conducted in other states. The hub exemption does neither. It is true that, as one of the other counsel have pointed out, this area of the law lacks precise contours. The Supreme Court itself has noted as much in the Boston Stock Exchange case. There was a question about whether this court should wait for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide Cuno. Unless the court decides the case strictly on the basis of the federal statutory argument, the Department of Revenue would urge the court to wait, and this is why. At this point in time, there is this uncertainty about the outer parameters of what constitutes an impermissible burden on interstate commerce, and the Cuno case is well poised to address that. As has been described, there were two different kinds of tax incentives at issue in that case. The Sixth Circuit upheld one, credit on personal property taxes, and it struck down another, an investment tax credit on franchise taxes. There were actually three petitions for certiorari review filed in the U.S. Supreme Court. Only two have been granted. And those two are the petition of the State of Ohio and the petition of Daimler Chrysler. And they both go only to the incentive that was struck down by the Sixth Circuit. The incentive that the Sixth Circuit approved, which was the personal property tax credit, was the subject of a petition by taxpayers, of which Ms. Cuno was one. And that petition has not been acted on by the United States Supreme Court. What that strongly signals is that the court is not concerned about the holding of the Sixth Circuit approving the personal property credit, but is concerned about the striking down of the other incentive. And so for the sake of this court being able to benefit from increased clarity in this whole somewhat confusing area, the department would encourage the court to wait. And hopefully it won't be too long of a wait. Oral argument is scheduled for March 1st in that case.
Ms. Burke, you indicated that we should wait unless, and I didn't fully understand your unless. Could you spell that out again for us, please?
Yes, Your Honor. If this court were to decide that the federal statute that Mr. Friebert was discussing permits the hub exemption, then there would be no need to go further and consider the Dormant Commerce Clause.
So you're talking about 49 U.S.C. 4116.
Yes.
Are you prepared to talk about that statute?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are you prepared to talk about that statute?
Your Honor, frankly, I can't improve on what Mr. Friebert has told you, but I'm glad to answer questions.
If I understood his argument, he is in effect saying that 4116D2A3, that's the levy or collect in ad valorem property tax, at a rate greater than the tax rate applicable to commercial industrial property. That's a no-no, right? That's a no-no. It's prohibited.
Yes, Your Honor.
To charge a higher tax rate.
Yes.
Right? And then if you look at 4116E1, it says, but a state may levy or collect taxes, including property taxes.
Yes.
Right? As I understood his argument, he is in effect saying that the property tax on airlines, including the hub exemption, does not fall within 3, a prohibited tax, does come under E1, a property tax, therefore no dormant commerce clause analysis.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, and the lesson of the ACF case, I believe, is that that power to tax also involves the power to exempt.
Under E1?
Yes.
So you can't discriminate against transportation companies, airlines, under 3, but there's nothing in the statute that says you can't discriminate between airlines in taxation through exemption.
Right.
And your position is that that's precise enough, because the cases seem to indicate if you're going to be, if the Congress is going to take over the dormant Commerce Clause by statute, they have to be precise.
Yes, Your Honor, and those were policy judgments for the Congress to make. If they don't like the results, Congress can revisit the subject again. This whole statute results from a reaction to the Evansville versus Vandenberg case that led to the Anti-Head Tax Act in the first place. So,
Counsel, I assume that you'd still have to pass equal protection, due process.
Yes, those would be additional constitutional guarantees that would have to be satisfied.
But you just think they're home free under Commerce Clause.
Congress has preempted this area, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Counselor, I want to skip your attention over to the timeliness of Northwest filing on the taxation. And my question was, do you know, is there either an administrative reg or something that either interprets or describes the requirements of 7608 sub 1?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I have looked and I have not found
nothing one. There. Okay, thank you.
So do you think the notice was misleading, the Department of Revenue?
I don't, Your Honor. There was nothing that was inaccurate in the notice. What they are complaining about is that information was not included in the notice. But frankly,
it wasn't a full notice, partial notice.
Yes. There's no requirement that any specific information be included in a notice of that kind.
Well, we had a number of cases dealing with administrative agencies saying, for heaven's sakes, tell them how to do it, because they're not being able to read the statutes, which are somewhat troublesome. Whether they're not reading them right or no one can read them right, tell them what to do and let's stop having these cases.
Yes, Your Honor, but even the even the provision of Chapter 227 that requires specific content in notices only requires information about filing, doesn't require information about service.
Counsel, even, you know, and you're right with regard to that, but then if there's some confusion and you don't have it in and there remains some confusion, then you may be subject to the, okay, liberal construction. Is it the Peterson case? I forget what the case name is, the one, the seminal case. Liberal construction to, you know, allow the case to get to its merits if there's some ambiguity and confusion.
Yes, Your Honor, but Peterson also requires that the interpretation be a reasonable one, the alternate interpretation. And it's the Department's position that Northwest's interpretation was not reasonable.
Given the statutory history, I'm going to talk about legislative history, given the statutory history, when in 1975 those two clauses were the subject of separate subdivisions, B and C, if I recall correctly, at least two separate subdivisions, maybe it's A and B, and that one, I guess it's A, within 30 days after notice of assessment has been mailed to the company, an action for redetermination is commenced by filing a summons and complaint with that court. That's A. And then B, so that's 30 days, file the summons and complaint. And then, and B, service of authenticated copies of summons and complaint is made upon the department. And there's no reference to 30 days or 90 days or any days. It seems to me that given this history and if I recall this statutory
predecessor. And if I recall correctly, when there was the change getting rid of the subsections, it wasn't intended to be any change of substance.
Yes, Your Honor. The 30-day service requirement initially originated in a piece of 1967 legislation. And there the legislature itself changed the service requirement to 30 days. Now, only the legislature can waive the state's sovereign immunity and specify the conditions under which the state can be sued. Then in 1975, the next change was not a legislative change. It was a change ordered by this court in its rulemaking authority on petition of the Judicial Council. Now, the Judicial Council petition, there was a Marquette University law professor who served as a reporter, not someone from the Legislative Reference Bureau who would have been drafting things all the time. It was also the product of quite a long and collaborative process, and I think it's understandable how during the course of that process, the sub A and sub B structure that you've mentioned resulted in a way that it might not had the Legislative Reference Bureau done its usual drafting job. Nevertheless, the history that accompanied that Judicial Council petition was very clear that service and filing both were required within 30 days, and this court had ordered that comment printed, and it's appeared in the statute book ever since. Section 76.08 is a very short statute, and I believe that's the only comment printed with that statute. So it's immediately apparent how the history connects to the language. I think it also bears mentioning that this doesn't seem to have been confusing to anybody else. I've been able to find no other cases in which this type of time problem occurred, and in fact, in previous years, appears not to have been an issue with Northwest. And so I think that suggests some human error occurred in the 2002 filing, as opposed to having a confusing statute.
I'd like to shift your attention to another statute, 7011-42A2B. And I want to know if you agree with counsel that perhaps that paragraph is not on as firm a footing as 2A is of subsection 42.
Your Honor, I think it's on a different footing from the first one. The statute provides two different formulations of a hub for air carriers in the state, and they both serve the same general purpose, which we've explained in our briefs as facilitating the flow of commerce by serving as the hub and spokes of parts of the national air carrier network. It is true that sub A corresponds more with what we would typically think of as a hub, where you've got flights coming in from different places and non-stop flights going out to other places. That's kind of a bigger piece of the national transportation system than what's addressed by sub B. And here in Wisconsin, we have a good example. We have a smaller local company headquartered in the state willing to provide air carrier service to smaller communities who wouldn't be served by the type of larger airline providing service through a hub in a city like Milwaukee. So by virtue of that smaller company being willing to serve those smaller communities, they're more directly connected to the national air carrier network and are able to participate more freely in commerce. So it makes sense, I think, if you think of it in that fashion.
Thank you.
But whether it makes sense or not, I guess the question becomes under sub B, that does it discriminate in favor of a local in-state company to the detriment of a company that's headquartered in another state? Isn't that the analysis that we would have to go through if we reach the Commerce Clause analysis?
Well, not necessarily, because there is this ambiguity around the parameters of what constitutes an impermissible burden for purposes of dormant Commerce Clause analysis. One way to think of this, one of my colleagues offered up this example. The smaller company with the headquarters in the state sending out its flights to different smaller communities could be considered like the Chaux Air Service that was a feature of the Miami Vice television show some time ago.
You're getting beyond our expertise, I think.
Bad day. The earlier one dealt with baseball or football. Now I was out of that. Now you're dealing with TV. Let's stick to something I understand.
Even judges have to do something besides the law sometimes.
Miami Vice.
What about books? Literature. Go ahead.
Well, let me try the contrasting example. I'm sorry to say it's drawn from another television show, Wings, which involved kind of an idiosyncratic local airlines based on Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard or somewhere like that, running flights only into Boston. And I think those two examples develop the difference between the type of a smaller local hub that would benefit from sub B and just any small airline anywhere, and why there's a rational reason for the legislature to make that policy choice.
But is that the test under the Commerce Clause? I mean, I thought it was the third prong that we're dealing with in the test, and Burlington describes it. Thus, no state may impose a tax which discriminates against interstate commerce for providing a direct commercial advantage to local business. Now, you're saying it may provide a commercial advantage to local business, but that's not the intent. Is that what you're arguing?
I'm saying that's not the determining factor, because the determining factor is whether the exemption promotes the purposes that the Commerce Clause was designed to serve, which are to promote free trade throughout the nation and across the states.
Oh, but that kind of argument then, it seems to me, just, you know, eviscerates everything, because as long as it's good for free trade, beginning and end of analysis.
Well, we know some things. Some things are not permissible. It's not permissible to deprive citizens of a state their right to participate in the markets of other states on equal terms. It's not permissible to discriminatorily tax business operations performed in another state. But the example that you have described wouldn't necessarily involve discriminatory tax by Wisconsin of business operations performed in Minnesota or Michigan or any other state. They would be governed by the states where they're located.
Sounds to me that a company that just operates between the islands and Boston, it's given as a tax break, favors intrastate commerce over interstate commerce.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, my example got confusing. That company, just operating on the one flight, would not qualify as a hub and would not be able to benefit from.
If they've got 20 each weekday, make it a bigger island.
Okay. Well, then it would fall within the hub exemption, and I suppose you could postulate other ways in which that would serve the purposes of interstate commerce. Airline running 20 flights a day into a major city like Boston might be promoting ability to participate in interstate commerce in the city, move on to other locations. I'd like to talk.
Could I ask you the same question I asked Mr. Friebert? If Northwest were to win and they were to get their taxes back, what would be the total cost to the state considering other airlines?
Your Honor, at this point, I believe it would be approximately $25 million in rounded figures. The exemption went into effect in 2004, and the assessments on air carriers have ranged between $6 and $7 million a year in each of the 4 years since then. There are some air carriers that for 2005 have not paid their full assessments. Northwest is one because of its intervening bankruptcy. Also, Delta and some of its subsidiaries have not fully paid their 2005 assessments for the same reason.
If the assessment, excuse me, if the exemption is invalidated, is it the department's position that Midwest would have to pay for past years?
No, Your Honor. I think there's some tendency to mix together the issue of severability and the issue of remedy. Let me start with severability. I have to respectfully disagree with the positions of both Northwest and Midwest that the hub exemption would not be severable if found unconstitutional. Now, there's really two issues here, what the Constitution requires and what state law permits by way of remedy. So severability goes to what the law would be after the finding of unconstitutionality. And despite the fact that a legislative fiscal bureau analyst who may or may not have been legally trained at one point said, well, as one option, the legislature could put a severability provision in here, there was no mention in that same fiscal note of the already existing severability provision in the statutes, which is very directive. Unless the legislature's intent to the contrary is manifest, the following rules shall apply. Now, after Kalal, I think that's more clearly directive than ever before.
Don't we have manifest intent here, though?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You don't have the intent of the legislature to not tax the hub facilities?
Well, Your Honor, air carriers have been taxed under Section 76.08, sub 1, since approximately 1945, when they were added to that statute. So air carriers, including Midwest, were taxed by the legislature long before the hub exemption ever was created.
But in 2001, the legislature made it clear that we don't want to tax these hubs, didn't they?
Yes, but the legislature is presumed to have acted with knowledge of the law in existence at that time, including the severability provision of Section 990.001, sub 11. There was no need for a specific severability provision here because that already existed and the legislature was presumed to know it. This case is very different from Burlington Northern because in Burlington Northern, there the exemption had existed as part of the statute since its creation. There was no statute without the exemption. But here we have a long history of taxation of air carriers, no indication whatsoever from the legislature itself that if this hub exemption were to be found unconstitutional, that it would prefer no taxation of any air carriers over just severing the unconstitutional provision as the law requires and moving on.
Okay, now if I understand your position is should it be found, the exemption be found unconstitutional, it is severable. That leaves everyone taxable at the moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the question is, what's the remedy? What's the remedy for the DOR to get money out of Midwest, and what's the, and I suppose Northwest doesn't have a remedy. Go ahead.
The remedy is provided by Section 76.08, and it is the redetermination procedure. The McKesson case that has been mentioned is very clear that states are afforded a lot of latitude in deciding what type of remedy to provide in this type of situation. It'd be required by due process when states are put in the position of paying their taxes and then afterward challenging them. McKesson and due process require meaningful backward-looking relief. In the hub exemption context, Section 76.08 provides a procedure whereby an aggrieved taxpayer can petition for redetermination, and if they win, then they get their money back. Now, McKesson's also clear that the taxpayer has to follow the state's procedural rules. And in this case, this one case, Northwest had a problem because it didn't timely serve the department. And so for this 1 year, Northwest is not entitled to get its money back. But Northwest has filed redetermination petitions for 2003, 2004, 2005, and I believe there's also one more for a reassessment type proceeding. And all of those were timely filed. They didn't have this service problem again. At the time that the department submitted its briefs in this case this summer, there were 10 cases, including this one, at various stages in Dane County Circuit Court. Now, with the issuance of the 2005 assessments in October, there are 16 cases.
I'm sorry. If this is held, if the exemption is held unconstitutional, why would Northwest get any money back?
Northwest would not get any money back for 2002.
I understand that. Why would it ever get any money? Because aren't you left with a tax on Northwest and then put a tax on Midwest if the exemption is illegal?
Because for 2003, 2004, and 2005, Northwest has timely objected that it was assessed under an unconstitutional statute for those years. So it's entitled to its money back for those years.
But do you think the whole statute is unconstitutional or just the exemption?
Your Honor, just the exemption, if anything.
All right. So if the exemption is declared invalid, right, what does Northwest get back, assuming it filed properly?
Northwest gets back its 2003, 2004, and 2005 ad valorem tax payments, and that's because McKesson requires backward-looking relief. They had to pay their taxes for those years before they could get a determination of whether they were being forced to pay under an unconstitutional law.
But they arguably would be paying under that part of the law
anyway
that it has constitutional, you know, vitality.
Right.
So
that's my point.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, If the hub exemption is found unconstitutional.
And it's severable. The rest of the statute provides for taxation.
And what that means is for 2006 and going forward, everyone, including Midwest and Air Wisconsin, is assessed. And Northwest just continues as it operated
Why
before.
Is it only prospective?
Why is it only prospective? Because the remedy that the state has chosen to provide for past deprivations is the redetermination procedure and the possibility of obtaining a refund. McKesson would allow the state to provide other types of relief, an injunction or some kind of combination of refund and injunction, but it's up to the state, and Wisconsin has chosen the 76.08 procedure.
So if I understand you, there's a perfectly valid statute. The exemption is wrong. So even though there's a perfectly valid statute with a bad exemption, everybody benefits from the declaration of severability in the past. This makes sense to me.
Clear in the language of 7608, if you are able to. If you're not, I'll muddle through it.
How can Northwest be aggrieved when there was a perfectly valid tax? The only reason they're aggrieved is that there's an exemption that's invalid. They didn't get the exemption. So it seems to me they paid perfectly good taxes. The problem is with Midwest, should it be declared invalid.
Well, the problem would be that for the years that the exemption existed, it shouldn't have been allowed, that there was a Commerce Clause violation that benefited Midwest to Northwest's detriment. And so to even the playing field for those years, because Midwest doesn't pay, Northwest preserved its rights, it gets its money back, too.
So for those years, it's not severable. For those years, the whole statute's gone.
Yes, but only those taxpayers
which who... Which they did the appropriate paperwork.
Yes. Thank you.
But American Eagle and anyone else who's in the mix here would get money back, too.
American Eagle has filed redetermination petitions for 03, 04, and 05, so they would get their money back for those years.
Everybody's filed. You didn't file, well, you filed improperly. Too bad. But if it's filed, you get all your money back. That's why you get to $25 million.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's $25 million?
Approximately, yes.
Other than pointing to 7608, are there any cases or construction of 7608 that you can provide that advances the remedy that you're discussing? I mean, it says any party aggrieved by the assessment or adjustment, but I'm not sure that that language necessarily causes me to think that the remedy that you're discussing is the remedy.
Your Honor, I think it's Section 76.23 that requires a refund if an assessment is found to have been improper under the redetermination provisions of
76. It wasn't improper. The tax on Northwest was not improper. What was improper was the exemption, assuming we agree that, the exemption of Midwest.
But if that's true, then we have to fix the problem that was created by the unconstitutionally uneven assessment in the years affected. And the way Wisconsin has chosen, this was legislative choice, was to pay back the money to those who did not receive the same benefit as Midwest of not paying.
Let me, Chief, may I? Let's say this exemption didn't exist. Would Midwest and Air Wisconsin's tax liability have been the same, regardless of whether or not this exemption exists?
No, if the exemption didn't exist, then Midwest and Air Wisconsin would have been liable for ad valorem taxes in 2002 through 2005. But because the exemption existed, they weren't assessed. They were exempt from
assessment. Yeah, I know. But does it affect the amount of money that Northwest would have to pay in ad valorem taxes if this hub exemption didn't exist, you know, prior to 2001? Did the amount of money in 2000 that Midwest had to pay an ad valorem tax, was that in any way affecting the amount that Northwest would have to pay?
No, Your Honor. Each air carrier is assessed separately based on the value of their property.
That's what I thought. Yes. So I'm having difficulty with the concept that in any way affects the liability. I mean, the tax was not improper. The exemption is improper. It seems like what I hear.
But the improper exemption creates a problem in the statute as a whole. And to even out the treatment of the taxpayers, that's why they have to be brought back somehow to parity.
You're relying solely on the statutes you quoted, not a case.
Your Honor, the McKesson case.
McKesson case.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Burke. Mr. Schott, do we have to change the name of this case in light of the fact that Northwest is in bankruptcy?
I believe not, Your Honor. And
have you advised the bankruptcy court about this pending case?
I believe they're aware of it, but if you're referring to the automatic stay provisions of the bankruptcy code, those apply to actions in which the bankrupt estate is a defendant or is potentially liable to pay money, and that's not the case here because we have paid the assessments. We're, in essence, a plaintiff here seeking to recover money. So those
gets the money when you recover. Does it go into the bankruptcy court?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I am assuming that's the case, Your Honor, but I...
You're not going to worry about that at the moment, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Okay.
What I'd like to do in my time for rebuttal is talk about some of the Supreme Court cases that I think do give this Court some very good guidance in interpreting the Dormant Commerce Clause, and particularly the Boston Stock Exchange case, which I think is very informative. In that case, the state of New York levied a tax on stock transactions. And the way that tax worked is they taxed every transaction involving a sale of stock that occurred in New York or that was done by somebody that was a resident of New York, whether they used an out-of-state brokerage firm to do that or not. And in the 1960s, New York became concerned that there were competitive stock exchanges coming up around the country, the Boston Stock Exchange being the primary example, and that the New York Stock Exchange, which obviously is a big economic factor and player in the state of New York and in the city of New York, was at a competitive disadvantage because the state of New York was levying this tax. And so what the state legislature did is passed a law that said if you're a resident of New York and you're involved in a stock transaction, you pay the full tax, whether it's through the New York Stock Exchange or one of the other stock exchanges. But if you're a non-resident, for example, if you're a resident of Wisconsin and you use the New York Stock Exchange, we're going to reduce the tax by half. So what they did is they actually reduced the tax that non-residents paid, but they did it because they were intending to benefit the New York Stock Exchange and take away this competitive disadvantage that the New York Stock Exchange said it was feeling that was giving rise to the increase in competition by the Boston Stock Exchange and others. And the United States Supreme Court, in a unanimous opinion, said you cannot do that under the Dormant Commerce Clause. And they said, and this is a quote, and I believe Justice Bradley used this quote earlier, no state consistent with the Commerce Clause may impose a tax which discriminates against interstate commerce by providing a direct commercial advantage to a local business. Well, there can't be any doubt that's exactly what is going on here. This hub exemption provides a direct commercial advantage to Midwest and Air Wisconsin by exempting it from property taxes that other airlines have to pay. And why? Because they have operations in the state of Wisconsin that come within the definition of hub exemption. Now, the Boston Stock Exchange could have moved to New Rochelle and become the New Rochelle Stock Exchange, but that didn't save, the fact that that was the case didn't save the New York tax from the constitutional challenge, nor should the fact that every airline in the United States could move to Wisconsin and have its hub be in Wisconsin save this tax. It provides a direct commercial advantage to a local business and therefore is unconstitutional. And Justice Rogenstein, we had some colloquy earlier and I know you asked follow-up questions about the prospective nature. I think what's significant about the prospective nature, at least in this context, is what we're talking about in terms of being prospective is that the distinction that the legislature is making is based on activity that somebody has already taking place in the state, a connection with the state. They are advantaging companies that have already done things in this state, and that is what you can't use your taxing power for. Now, one of the questions that hasn't come up here yet, but a logical question that the legislature dealt with is, how about if we just give Midwest the money? How about if we just give them a direct subsidy? And the cases make very clear that there is a distinction in the case law between using the tax power of the state to accomplish a purpose like this, as opposed to a direct subsidy. And I think the Chief Justice asked a question early on in this argument about rewarding businesses for maintaining operations in the state. And we're not saying that can't be done, but you can't do it through this mechanism. You can't do it through the tax code. And I think that's a lesson not only the Boston Stock Exchange case, but also the Westinghouse case, the Bacchus case, which dealt with the liquor tax in Hawaii, and the New Energy Company of Indiana case, all of which were tax provisions that were designed to provide some benefit, some competitive advantage for a local in-state company, all of which the United States Supreme Court said do not pass muster under the Dormant Clause of the Commerce Clause, the Dormant Power of the Commerce Clause.
Chief, may I?
Yes, fair enough.
I'm still back on severability. What difference does it make to you at all assuming, let's say, it's unconstitutional, something's unconstitutional, does the severability argument make any difference to you at all?
Yes.
Well, then my question is why? Because I just heard prior counsel say if it's severable, you still get paid. Suppose if it's not severable, you get paid. So what's the deal?
I think that if this provision is not severable, then the only result that is possible is that we cannot be assessed the tax.
That's right. What about but the counsel is saying if it's severable, you still get the same remedy. I mean, and so why, if I were you, if you win whether it's severable or it's not severable with regard to remedy, you know, assuming that you, of course, prevail on a lot of other issues, why waste a page of ink on the issue? Makes no difference to you.
If they're going to give us our money back, whether or not the decision of this court is that it's severable, then we'll take the money back.
Should I tear this out?
We'll take the money back.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's consistent with the position they've always taken. But
the difference is whether you applied properly.
For the 1 year, there's that issue. Clearly, there's no issue with respect to the other years.
And that may be the distinction. Between right. severability right. and not severability.
But certainly if the comments of the Department of Revenue at this hearing are indication that if the law is declared unconstitutional, we're going to get our money back either way, then that's all I have to say about severability, Your Honor.
The state may be in bankruptcy with you. That's a joke.
There's evidence in the record about the size of the state budget, and $25 million, while it may be a significant amount of money to all of us in the room, is a very small percentage of the state budget.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Probably a good part of the court's budget.
I don't argue with that, Your Honor.
Maybe a third. Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Thank you, Mr. Freeburg. Thank you, Ms. Burke, for your arguments today in a difficult case. And I don't think I've seen or heard dormant Commerce Clause since law school days. And I understood it very well at that time, to the best of my ability. That concludes our hearing in 04AP0319, Northwest Airlines versus Wisconsin Department of Revenue. The court has completed its oral argument for the month of December. I will not hear any cases until the first week or thereabouts in January. The court is adjourned, and we will go into closed conference at about 10:04. Yes, sir.
We don't need that long, do we?
Well, some of us might.